Evolutionary.org presents Evolutionary Hardcore Podcast with your co-hosts, Steve from the American Underground and Mobster from the UK Iron Den. Get ready for the most hardcore and underground info in the industry. And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6...
Evolution.org Hardcore 2.0 is coming your way. This is episode 190. Today we're going to talk about Retruda-Tribe and how bodybuilders can benefit by Parapharma. So in this one, we are going to go deeper under the hood. We've done a couple of podcasts on Retruda-Tribe, and it's coming fast. There's a lot of new information coming out. There's new articles. There's new studies that are coming out. We have more and more people using it now as it becomes more mainstream in the bodybuilding world. So we're able to bring you some of the best information on it. We're also going to kind of give our unique perspectives on how you can best use this compound for fat loss success, because it is a compound that is not officially FDA approved as of this podcast, but it should be in the next year or two. So if you do get a hold of it, you want to make sure that you run it the right way, because you're not going to have a doctor's guidance when it comes to this particular drug at this time. But first, let me remind everyone, we are on Apple, we are on Spotify. We do, you know, things differently on this podcast. We're trying to bring you information and help you. We're not doing this podcast to, start our own crypto scam coin. We're not doing this podcast to get views on our social media, on our Instagram. We're not doing this video to do shock bait information, you know, to get a lot of followers and a lot of controversy. We're doing this, you know, to help people. And this is really our method of this podcast. And we're growing the channel quite a bit. You know, we have quite a bit of views on our videos so far. But if you want our podcast to continue, you got to help us out. You got to like, you got to subscribe, tell your friends and family, check us out on all the platforms, comment, give us a rating and all that good stuff. And that keeps our podcast going. That helps the algorithms pick us up. So without further ado, let's get into it. So Retruda-Tribe, also called LY-343-7943. It's considered the most modern GLP-1 drug that is available currently in the bodybuilding scene, designed for both diabetes and obesity. And that is where it's going into trials. Although it's not FDA approved yet, as I said, it should be approved within the next year or two. It might be 2 years, 3 years even, but it should get approved pretty quick. Eli Lilly has a really good track record on these types of drugs because they did get tirzepatide approved already. And the people who have been able to get their hands on Retruda-Tribe, and by the way, for example, Umbrella is a really good source. You can come on the forum and find out where to get Retruda-Tribe. I've been able to get my hands on it and try it myself. Other people on the forum have been able to get their hands on it. And then, of course, people who have used it as part of these studies have been able to get their hands on it. And it's been showing some amazing things. Eli Lilly, as I said, they've been developing it. Their wildly successful drug called tirzepatide already was FDA approved. Maybe 3 years ago, back in 2022, I believe. So people have been switching from semaglutide to tirzepatide. Once Retruda-Tribe gets approved, you're going to see people start switching from tirzepatide to Retruda-Tribe, as it would be the more modern option. So what are the differences between tirzepatide and Retruda-Tribe? Retruda-Tribe, triple agonist hormone receptor medicine. Tirzepatide is a dual agonist hormone receptor medicine. Semaglutide is only a single agonist. Semaglutide was made by a different company, Novo Nordisk. Tirzepatide and Retruda-Tribe, as I said, are developed by Eli Lilly. At this, you know, the way it's looking is Novo Nordisk, they're getting their clocks cleaned, okay? They're getting their clocks cleaned. And we're seeing a transition and a graduation from people who were on semaglutide previously, which was an awesome drug before. We are going to do a podcast on semaglutide. We have done a couple podcasts already on semaglutide. It's an awesome drug. And you got to give Novo Nordisk credit for coming up to it. They are trying to improve on their semaglutide to keep up with Eli Lilly. So if we're going to take a look in this podcast, and I'm going to explain the mechanisms of action on these drugs so you can understand the differences between these GLP-1 agonists. And you're also going to understand with the studies how retatrutide has been shown to be the most effective GLP-1 out there. And there's other GLP-1s out there. I've seen at least two or three others that are being sold now through underground labs or through chemical companies, and they've been coming on. So, but in my opinion, I think retatrutide, Mobster, has to be the number one option right now, from what I've seen. And until proven otherwise, that would be the one that you should use. And that's the one I trust myself. And I recommend retatrutide always as the number one option to my clients as well. Go ahead.
Absolutely, Steve. I mean, like Steve's just said, that the introduction to the market of semaglutide was a step in the right direction. And we've covered, as Steve says, on other shows, the science of how that works. But for obvious commercial reasons, if for no other reason, you instantly look at, can I produce this product, but in a better way that sells better? And one of the things I've said on other shows when we've discussed all the GLP type of products is that I love the thought process that the site is taking. And especially when you compare it to previous products that were treating weight loss, previous products that were trying to treat diabetes, and the thought process. And the thought process specifically, Steve, is this whole idea of looking at what the body does under ideal conditions for someone who doesn't struggle with weight loss or doesn't struggle with diabetes, and what the body does. And can we mimic that rather than, for example, insulin or weight loss medications that come with horrible side effects and so on and so forth. So yeah, look, one of these the links that I'm going to talk about in terms of studies here today, Steve, specifically looks at all of the studies that have been done, or a multiple amount of studies that have been done, and holds these up to make sure. So look, one of the things I've said on shows, and I'm kind of good at this particular thing, Steve, in that if only by speed reading, I look at how studies are put together and I question whether the study has bias. I question whether, for example, if the study's been sponsored by a company, how much more likely you're going to get a positive outcome from that study. If the company that's produced a medication and has paid for the study, it's kind of almost in the scientists that do the study's interest to produce a positive result. We don't get to hear about the negative ones naturally, of course, and so on and so forth. You look at what's called peer review type stuff, Steve, where people that are studying the same thing as you look at how the study's put together. Is it randomized? Is the people have literal bias, unconscious bias? As an example, one study we looked at previously, Steve, both the participants, i.e. the people that was being studied and using one of the GLP products, and the people administering the injection once a week, they were all masked up. They wanted to minimize even a racial bias. They wanted to minimize the bias for the sex of the person. They wanted to minimize the bias for the age, and so on and so forth. You also get stuff like when it's completely randomized, the person administering the injection does not know that the participant So yeah, to remove as much bias as possible to make sure that there's no sort of outside influences. One of the things we've looked at on these shows is we looked at what's called stage one, stage two, stage three, and stage four. And just as an example, the obvious thing is you want to make sure that there's no side effects. There have been drugs administered in this country where everybody essentially nearly died. It shouldn't have been an issue. The dosages were low, Steve. Their skin started to go maroon and then black. It was a closed environment, and there was like, what the fuck's happened here? So you look at obviously toxic issues. You measure the lethality of a drug if you give them more and more of the prescribed amount, to the point of how dangerous is it. You do that with animals, of course. You also do things like, and I think this is stage two or stage three, Steve, where you compare it to the traditional available treatments. The study today, for example, is comparing all of these GLP type one type drugs And as an example, just a line here, 26 randomized controlled trials. So like I said already, the random aspect, comparing it to other possible treatments, comparing it to previous traditional treatments, and so on and so forth. And all of these things, ultimately, I think more now than there's ever been before, and this is really, really good when it comes to GLP-1 type products or GLP type products, there is more testing available, more comparative testing available, and more percentage of the population. And one of the things that you and I have touched upon, I believe, on one of our shows, I think we were looking at something stupid like 27,000 participants in 26 countries at 600 different locations. So you absolutely want these products to work. You want them to work for as many people as possible. You want to be them as safe for as many people as possible. And as an example, again, Steve, one of the studies was 72 weeks, which I believe we talked about. So well over a year. This is not something you take once and never take again. It's something you need to take on a regular basis. As an example, again, we've seen proven effectiveness, not just in the initial stages and then it sort of wears off, but literally, I believe we talked about one third of a person's body weight in terms of obesity. So they lost an enormous amount of fat. And they were consistently doing this on a fixed dose every single week of the time that they were using it for. I think in that example, Steve was 40 plus weeks. So we look at them. Scientists are looking at the studies, not just doing the studies, but looking at the actual studies that have been performed,
Yeah.
making sure that these are proper and done well, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I really believe retatrutide is one of the best drugs ever produced, like in the modern era, especially considering what it does for diabetics, what it does for fat loss. And we're gonna kind of go over some of the things that it does in this next section. And let me talk about what it does in the body. And it does something which is very, very cool. And it does three things as a triple agonist. So, number one, regulates insulin secretion and appetite by acting on the GLP-1 receptor. And GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1. So, it does exactly what tirzepatide and semaglutide 1. All those other drugs do the same thing. The GLP-1 agonists, they act on that receptor. But here's where retatrutide shines, is it does two more things versus semaglutide, which only does one thing, and versus tirzepatide, which only does two of these. Number two, it improves glucose and lipid metabolism by acting on a glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, which is the GIP receptor. So that's a cool thing. So it makes the GLP-1 effect even better. Number three, and this is the third thing that it does, and I'm really excited to see when they come up with a quadruple agonist, what would be the fourth thing the drugs does, or a quintuple agonist, or what, five different things. But this is the third thing that it does, is it changes your energy expenditure, Mobster, by acting on the glucagon receptors, GCG-R. And when we look at our bodies are a machine, and if you look at someone who is skinny as a rail, and you look at someone who's fat, obese, and they eat the same fucking diet. They eat the same fucking diet, but the skinny person, his body is the hormones in the body, the way the body functions as a machine, functions differently. So if you take a regular Honda and you put it next to a sports car, they're both cars, okay? They both are the same weight. They're both the same size. They both take the certain same amount of fuel. But why is one faster than the other? It's because what's inside. What's inside allows it to be faster. So when you take a fat person versus a skinny person, you put them on the same diet and you get two different results. It's not just, hey, that fat person isn't doing what they need to do. Well, the fat person exercises 1 hour a day. The skinny person exercises 30 minutes a day, but the skinny person stays skinny. The fat person just can't lose weight. So, what these drugs are capable of doing is it's capable of taking that fat person who's having trouble losing weight, even though they're trying to do everything the right way, they're doing everything the right way, and it allows them to do that just because it's changing your energy expenditure. We've seen a lot of drugs over the years that have attempted to do this, but the difference is they attempt to do them in different ways. We see like GW 501516, which is a PPAR agonist. Okay, it does it a different way. We see something like a clenbuterol, which is going to increase your heart rate, increase your metabolism, strain your central nervous system, cause a lot of side effects, enlarge your heart, do a lot of bad things. And a lot of people like to take clenbuterol to help them lose weight. Same thing with albuterol. We've seen things like DMP. DMP will cook you from the inside. It raises your body temperature so much that it cooks you from the inside and causes you to burn a lot of calories. And whenever you eat something, carbs, you like break out in a sweat when you take the DMP. So retruda doesn't do any of that shit. It doesn't cause these nasty side effects, but it changes your energy expenditure without causing these negative side effects. And that's, to me, what makes it such a cheat code, when it comes to these drugs out there. So it's going to turn your body into a fat burning machine versus a fat storing machine. But as we talk about later, you have to be doing things right. You have to eat good and you have to exercise on it to get the full benefits. You can't just take it, sit on the couch and eat potato chips and expect great results. Some people who do that will still lose weight. But for the vast majority, if you want the optimal results, just like the sports car, you got to give it the right fuel to get the most out of it. Otherwise, it's just going to break down. So, Monster, anything you want to add to that? The way
Yeah,
it
I
works in the
mean,
body?
look, one of the major considerations, and we will touch upon this briefly, with any of the GLP-1 type products is that you're looking for potential, and I'm going to talk about a news item later on in the show. You're looking for potential for examples of, and I'm going to give an example now, of products that are supposed to have helped people lose weight, but the side effects were so fucking goddamn uncomfortable, so goddamn disgusting, really, that regardless of whether they worked effectively or not, it just didn't quote unquote sell. And I mean that not just in terms of physical cash going over the counter, I just people just weren't attracted to the ease of using this particular product. And I looked up while Steve was talking, orlistat, I believe that's the right correct pronunciation, Steve. And the particular one that sticks in my mind, right? So this was a medicated, prescribed medication that was supposed to block fat in your diet. So you took this pill, you ate meal that may or may not contain a certain amount of fat, and the idea was that this particular medication stopped the fat being digested, and therefore it wouldn't go into your body, wouldn't be absorbed, wouldn't be utilized, and or potentially stored. So it wasn't necessarily increasing your metabolism. It was just allowing you in a perverse kind of way, Steve, to eat kind of crappy meals and not have to worry about the crappy meal part. Now, of course, one would suggest not eating crappy meals would be a lot fucking easier. But my favorite particular one, and I say favorite, it was quite disgusting, was the simple fact that this particular medication in the white slip, in the please read and this might happen to you while you're using our product, quite clearly stated that users might experience oily shits. And I quote, anal leakage, meaning quite simply that because it was so effective at blocking the fat, that undigested fat will come out in your shit when you excreted it, when you went to the toilet of the morning. But the problem being, of course, was because there was such a high percentage of fat in your lower intestine, in whatever the fuck it is, that's just before your ass, Steve. The oil was coming out while you were walking around for the day. So essentially you had oily shit stains in your underpants. And the simple, that idea that you're taking something because you're too goddamn lazy, to put it not crudely, to eat a cleaner diet and have a healthier lifestyle. So I'm going to take this prescribed medication that's going to block fat in my diet, basically gave you oily shits for obvious reasons, didn't sell, it didn't fly. So we know that there are some side effects from any medication, whether that's an over-the-counter painkiller, aspirin, whatever. Certain antibiotics require these are so horrible, and anti-inflammatories are so pain horrible on your stomach, you sometimes have to take a pill just to protect your stomach while you're using the anti-inflammatory for an injury. So nearly every medication out there has some kind of side effects. Arguably, with all of the GLP-1 type products, all GLP type products, you are seeing minimal side effects, most of which are around just changing the dose or initial use, and then your body gets used to it. Most of that is a little bit of discomfort for the most part, Steve. So yeah, again, some of the research is going to be looking at what you and I have had this. How many times have we discussed this? We haven't actually seen this recently. The amount of times people would say, "Oh, GW gives you cancer," and you go, "Okay, prove it. Go away and show me a single connection where an actual autopsy is being done or a literal reported case of someone getting cancer from using GW." Well, they couldn't do it. They could only say that, "Oh, if they gave 200 fucking times the recommended dose to a mouse, or in this case, a human being, it might at that level cause cancer." So studies, the way these things are done and so on. So what we're looking at, and I will touch upon the news item, but for the most part, all of the GLP-1s, and specifically what we're discussing today, I would argue to date, and it is kind of short term, but to date, with hundreds of thousands of doses, hundreds of thousands of users, we are seeing minimal to date. It might come out at some point in the future, and if it does, we will be sure to let you know. But minimal side effects realistically, and certainly when you compare it to having oily fucking shits or whatever, a lot better. Like the DNP that Steve referred to, we know people that have died, and I don't mean personally, but we've seen these things out there. People that have taken twice a dose didn't listen to the right dosages, and so on. We are not seeing that. So when Steve says this could be arguably a miracle type drug or a panacea, if you like, Steve, for people with obesity, for people with diabetes, abso-fucking-lutely, all of the GLP-1s, but specifically what we're discussing today, are kind of out there, almost like a miracle type drug to date. And again, I will address negative way of looking at it in terms of the news and specifically the examples they particularly given later on in the show.
Yeah, in diabetes, Monster went over the obesity comparison. Let's talk about diabetes a little bit, type 2 diabetes, and it does tie in to bodybuilding as well, because the more you bodybuild, the more insulin resistant you become. This is why you see bodybuilders when they go on these survival shows. You, for example, Mobster or a power lifter, if you went on the survival show, you wouldn't last very long, because you'd be like, after like the first day, you'd be like, oh my God, I'm dying, I'm dying. Because you need constant food, you need constant calories. You're so insulin resistant because you're
Let
so
me just
big.
give an example, Steve. I'm not actually
Yeah.
that
Go ahead.
bad,
Yeah, but
but
let me explain. I'm trying to get into it.
I've trained in the morning and gone out for a trail walk afterwards, and literally been the way that Steve described within 40 or 50 minutes. So yeah, it has happened. I'm a little bit better now than I was before, but absolutely what Steve just said.
Yeah, and if you were in America, you'd be a type 2 diabetic by now. With our standard of food. So what happens is, even with bodybuilders who are like ripped and they're huge bodybuilders, what happens is over time your body gets so used to eating every 2 to 3 hours. Every 2 to 3 hours, you're taking so many anabolic steroids. The more anabolic steroids you use over time, the more insulin resistant you use. So this ties into bodybuilding as well. But let's kind of talk about type 2 diabetes a little bit, and it's insulin resistance. And there's a lot of type 2 diabetics out there in America. We have a lot of them in China now. China has had a growing epidemic of type 2 diabetes thanks to sugar, thanks to American habits of eating fast food and restaurant food. Growing middle class has more money. They can go spend. China has a bigger middle class than America does now. They can afford to eat what they want when they want, just like us in America. And we have an abundance of food. We can eat whenever we want. We can pull up an app and eat whenever you want. And that's not good. That builds insulin resistance. So we have a big epidemic of type 2 diabetes. Everyone listening to this has a relative who's a type 2 diabetic or has a friend that's a type 2 diabetic. And why is retatrutide so much better? Well, let me explain why. And you're a type 2 diabetic. Let's say you take insulin. You might take insulin once a day, you might take insulin twice a day, you might take insulin 3 times a day. It just depends. If you eat chocolate cake for breakfast, you have to take your insulin to get your blood sugar back down. Then later on, you eat another shitty meal, some pizza, some cake, some ice cream. You gotta take your insulin to get your blood sugar down. Or you're on something like metformin or any of these other type 2 diabetes drugs. You might be on one medication, you might be on one medication and insulin, you might be on two medications, three medications, four medications, whatever. So imagine not having to take insulin during the day, constantly having to inject yourself. And imagine not having to worry about taking insulin everywhere you go and having to keep it in the refrigerator and being all stressed out. Oh my God, I lost my power. My insulin is going to go bad. It's sitting in my refrigerator versus just taking retatrutide once a week and being done with it. Because that is the advantage of retatrutide. Now, look, doctors out there, they don't like new things. They don't like new, some of them don't like new things, some of them. And some of them are always looking for the new thing. So a lot of doctors, they rather have their patients be over-medicated and take lots of insulin. And insulin, by the way, is a 100-year-old drug, 100-year-old hormone, I should say. Whether you want to describe it as a hormone or a drug, I would describe it as both. But it's been around 100 fucking years. So is that outdated, or am I losing my mind on this? So, it's been around since the 1920s, 1930s, and then became mainstream once the 40s, 50s, 60s came along. They started producing in a lab. It's produced in a lab now, and you can walk into any drugstore in America and walk up to the counter with or without a prescription and ask for insulin. You say, hey, it's for my dog, and then they'll give it to you. So they'll probably sell it to you for like 20, 25 bucks. So look, it's all over the place. I get it. A lot of you out there, you have relatives who are stubborn, who are old school, but they should probably talk to their doctor about getting on these GLP-1s instead. Because like I said, what would you rather do? Have to inject insulin once a day, twice a day, three times a day, or take these diabetes medications once a day, twice a day, three times a day? Or would you rather just inject one of these GLP-1s once a week and you're done? That's it. Once a week, boom, done. So it's a no-brainer. And I've heard people say, oh, the side effects on these GLP-1s aren't good. Listen, we're going to get into that in later. I'm going to explain to you why that's complete bullshit. And I'm going to explain that in a second. But let's first get into the studies on this stuff. And look, phase three studies are coming in 2026. As of this podcast, though, we have plenty of solid studies that have already been previously done, and we have more that are hitting the wire all the time. So they've shown improvements in things like HbA1c, which is long-term fasting glucose numbers. Short-term fasting glucose numbers, we've seen improvements in that as well. In other words, if you prick your finger and get your blood sugar taken, you'll see an improvement. Lipid health, blood pressure, and more. There also have been studies showing a reduction in tumor volume for things like pancreatic cancer. So that's pretty cool too. So it does other things. And look, there's a bunch of other things that it can benefit you with. Sleep apnea, anything having to do with, being overweight. Like if whatever it's direct and indirect benefits of being overweight. Because when you're overweight, you're going to have a lot of health problems. That comes with the territory. So let me talk about a study that showed on average users lost over 40 pounds or 18% of their body weight after just 6 months on this drug. The same study had people go for 11 months total, ended up losing an additional 15 pounds, an additional 7% of their body weight on top of that. So the longer you stay on it, the more body weight you lose. But of course, over time, as you lose body weight, you're not going to just keep losing body weight forever until you weigh nothing. You will obviously, as you lose weight, you'll lose less weight, less weight, less weight, but it's still going to be a substantial amount of weight. But they did it very healthy. Another study looks at results on the drug for a year, showed a 24% total weight loss when users use between 8 to 12 milligrams a week, which is a very strong dose. That's the strongest dose that I've seen in studies is 12 milligrams. And it compared it with other drugs, and it beat every other drug tested in the study, and it wasn't even close. So it beat tirzepatide, it beat semaglutide, it beat these other drugs. Mobster talked about a couple of drugs earlier that have been prescribed by doctors for fat loss. It blew them away. Like across the board, it kicked the shit out of every drug. It was a number one, 24% total weight loss, Mobster. That is a huge amount. So if you're 400 pounds, you lost 100 pounds on this stuff. That is incredible over a course of a year. If you're 300 pounds, You lost what, 80, 90 pounds? I mean, that's just incredible. That's life-changing numbers. Another study, I'll do one more before I let you and Mobster talk about what you came up with. Another study involved 350 adults. It was almost an even split among male and females. Those who only ran 1 milligram for 24 weeks, which is a very minimal dose, still lost over 7% of their body weight. Those who did 4 milligrams lost 13%. Those who did 8 milligrams lost 17%. Those who did 12 milligrams lost the most at 18%. So you can see there's not much of a difference between 8 and 12 milligrams, but there is a substantial difference between those who ran 1 milligram and ran 4 milligrams or who went, ran 8 milligrams. So based on these studies, I think those of you listening would get really good results maximum at 4 or 5 milligrams. I don't see any point in going higher. The most I've ever ran on it, let me check my notes here just to make sure. So the most I've ever ran of retatrutide is 2.4 milligrams. And I don't see any point of me running anything more than that. And I like a dose of 1.5 to 2 milligrams for myself. But we're gonna get into dosing in a second. Here's a cool thing though, Mobster, before I let you in. The placebo group who was put on the same diet, put on the same exercise program, lost only 1%. So when I talk about, IFYM, if it fits your macros, look, in this example, everybody was doing the same thing. Everybody was doing the same thing, okay? We had 350 adults all doing the same diet, same exercise. Do you think it was just a coincidence? The placebo group only lost 1%, but the people who took retatrutide lost some between 7 and 18%, depending on the dosing they were using. It's not a coincidence. This drug changes what goes on in your body. It changes the hormones that are going on in your body. It is a miracle drug, and it is a fantastic, fantastic drug. It really is. And it's going to basically change a lot of people's lives out there if you're willing to run it the right way. Mobster, you have some studies here. Why don't you talk about the studies you came up with?
Yeah, so one is actually a news item, Steve, and it kind of annoyed me, and I'm going to say why. Okay, now this is from diabetes.co.uk, and the title is called "A Retatrutide Melts Fat Fast, but at a Cost," warn experts. Now, the other study I'm going to refer to, the one that looked at a bunch of studies, had 15,000 participants across the 26 studies. And as I said earlier on, we've done other podcasts, Steve. I believe we were looking at 26 or 27,000. So what was really annoying here, bearing in mind this would be a responsible site to discussing diabetes treatments, and they quote, talked to experts. When you look at the fucking numbers, it's really, really annoying, and I'll say for why. So it starts off by talking about just how successful these products are, just how great the results for people have been in terms of fat loss and so on. And it says, and I quote, "May come with concerning side effects, including bone fractures and kidney issues." Talks about early trials, people losing a quarter of their body weight, and so on and so forth. All right. But one of the this is how silly this is. So imagine, like I've just said, 15,000 participants in what might be called a meta study. But some participants, this is the quote, "in clinical trials reported losing too much weight too rapidly." And then they quote two fucking people. Two, arguably out of tens of thousands of users, just based on the statistical information that we've given you earlier in the show. Two, one individual, Steve, dropped 22% of their body weight in just 9 months and felt compelled to skip dosages to slow down the effects. I don't know where to go with this one, Steve. You lost more fat than you've ever lost in your fucking life, and you were losing fat too quickly. And they're quoting this like it's a news item. One person, one. Another one, it says, and we've actually seen examples of this, but again, we'll get to why. Another lost nearly a third of their body weight, exactly like Steve said earlier on, in 8 months, and developed kidney stones, a potentially dangerous condition. Notice how they've very carefully worded that. They're not blaming the medication. Yet here's this fucking line in the middle of the article suggesting that they got kidney stones as a result of using this. Is
So let
that
me
incorrect?
jump in.
Yeah,
So
go on.
a good reason why you can get kidney stones is dehydration. So when you're using, how do you think your body is getting rid of the body fat? It's either getting rid of it through your breath, through your sweat. This is why when you do fasting, you smell really bad when you're fasting. Your breath stinks, your armpits stink, because your body is getting rid of the body fat. Now, the other way it gets rid of your body fat is through your urine. And some of you are gonna notice that. You'll be peeing a lot more on it. So my theory on this person had, kidney stones, which we all do, by the way. I actually got an what is it called? The sonogram or whatever the hell it is. My,
Ultrasound, Steve.
yeah, an
Ultrasound. I think that's
ultrasound.
where they break them up.
So my doctor that I go to, she's always insisting I go get ultrasounds because kidney stones run in my family. So I the last one I did, she said, you have a stone. It's not big enough where it needs to be treated, but you need to keep an eye on it. So here's the thing with me. If I'm fasting a lot, or if I'm taking a GLP-1 in this case, and I'm pissing out a lot and I'm not rehydrating enough, which is difficult to do, because you will notice on these GLP-1s, especially initially, you're going to be peeing a lot more, and and you're going to pee a lot more than you bring in. So it is really annoying because you're drinking like a, let's say you drink a half a gallon of water a day, you'll probably pee out like a gallon of water because your body is expelling that body fat. But anyway, if this person wasn't hydrating properly and lost all this weight so fast, it makes sense that their kidney stone that they had previously would get big enough where it would be an issue. So if you do a lot of exercise outside, okay, and you're sweating a lot, there's a good chance that you will have kidney stone issues at some point. Probably, I'm guessing sometime in your late 40s and into your 50s, that's gonna happen. If you, like me, you live in a hot climate, you're always sweating, just going outside to check the mail, you already break in a sweat because it's brutally hot, then there's a good chance that you will end up with kidney stone. So that would be a reason why this person got kidney stone. So was it the
Yeah,
retruditride that caused a kidney stone? No, but it was
exactly.
indirectly, they weren't hydrating enough. And a lot of times it's not possible to hydrate enough, especially you said 33% of their body weight,
Yeah,
or was it 25%?
30, 31% was the bit one of the
Okay,
biggest.
that's an insane amount of body weight. And of course, he
And
probably was
when we
peeing
say body weight,
buckets.
Steve, this is the phrase they like to use when they say weight loss. And of course, what we're realistically looking at is fat loss. We've discussed on a previous show the idea that you might have some muscle loss. And I pointed out that because your body no longer requires the amount of muscle that was needed to move your fat ass around by your 300 pounds or whatever it was that you weighed, some small percentage of untrained individuals, i.e., the people listening to the show typically go to the gym. That's our demographic. The average person does not. 90% of the population doesn't do regular workouts or keep fit or whatever. So some muscle loss is done simply by virtue of the fact that you don't require that amount of muscle to move around the superfluous fat that you were carrying before. Example here, and they spoke to an associate professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, who noted that some of his patients who had used, and I quote, similar weight loss treatments, so not necessarily the same medication, became frail and even suffered fractures. So one of the inferences elsewhere that kind of ties into this was and I quote, a decrease in bone density. It's the same as the muscle loss. You no longer weigh 400 pounds. You no longer weigh 300 pounds. So a small decrease in bone density will occur by simple virtue of the fact that your body no longer requires thicker, heavier, stronger, whatever the fuck bones to carry your fat ass around. I've said on a show previously, Steve, if I weigh 600 pounds and I will still go out and get my daily steps, that I would actually be carrying a good deal of muscle tissue and dense bones simply by virtue of being able to be mobile weighing 600 pounds. You lose 31% of your body weight, and what they really mean is fat loss, some muscle loss, and some decrease in bone density in the untrained individual to be expected. The fact that they've had to go and talk to an associate professor of medicine is kind of stupid. And it's really disappointing that diabetes.co.uk has come across this article. And I say it really because I would almost expect this from a tabloid newspaper. The let's see what we can say, and we'll speak to one expert who goes with this stupid idea. Again, tens of thousands of users just in the studies that we quoted, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of users of the GLP-1 type products. Worldwide, Steve. No, what did I say earlier on? I think it was 264 or something ridiculous in the hundreds of locations and just under 30 different countries, and 27,000 in one of the studies that we looked at before, total participants. And they found two examples. And they said, oh, you might decrease your bone density or you might lose a little bit of muscle. Well, fuck me in blind, Steve. That makes you and me rocket scientists. It's disappointing. It's like they're looking in a non-studied, non-scientific way for negative aspects. And then they put this fear-mongering stuff out there. It's like they almost want people to be on insulin or they want people to continue traditional medications. They're kind of, and yet we know that insulin comes with issues. We know that reliance on insulin is an issue. We know that obesity is an issue. They even talk about, just at the end of this article, just to finish on this, this is the same doctor that they spoke to. Experts, and I'll refer to the doctor in a second, have long warned about the risk associated with extreme and rapid weight loss. And again, fat loss, a little bit of muscle tissue. We're looking at mostly fat here. The doctor again, how much weight, how much is too much weight loss is unknown. And we really need additional data and studies to look at it. I'm sorry, doc. What the fuck have you been doing all your life? Look out the fucking window, as Steve said earlier about the propensity for type 2 diabetes, the propensity in modern, but especially first and second world societies for obesity, and tell me that that's more healthy than people actually being successful on a week-to-week basis. And it's not a massive amount per week, Steve. What we looked at before was 1 to 2 pounds a week, but consistently for the whole time, and he tapered off a little bit at the end, dose dependent, with, for the most part, because we haven't really seen serious issues, apart from these bullshit quotes, in terms of potential side effects or proper side effects above and beyond upset stomachs and a little bit of nausea when the medication dosages are changed. And it's almost like they're looking for a reason not to get in shape. Do you know what, Steve? If I was being a complete and utter wanker, I'm wondering if the writer and or the doctor are a little bit out of shape, or there's an actual, and this has been put out for the medical community before, and like Steve said, there's always going to be good and bad doctors. I'm almost thinking as though they feel like they're going to lose some income from not being able to treat their overweight and fat patients. And diabetic patients, and so on and so forth. Because if this medication worked, the price will come down, more people are using it, and you'll simply have less people that require all the other morbidity and obesity type treatments
Yeah,
and
everything. Yeah,
causes and effects.
everything. There's always going to be scare tactics with everything. People will say, "Oh, don't go to Mexico. It's dangerous. Mexico's dangerous." Keep saying it, motherfuckers. Keep saying Mexico's dangerous. Keeps the price down and keeps people from going. And then we have people on the forum. Where I just talked to a guy on the forum who has a place in Mexico and he loves it. He goes there just on vacation, hangs out, chills for a couple weeks, and then comes back. So I mean, it's great. I mean, you can get a place there for like a 20, like 75% less because people are so scared of going to
You know
Mexico. So,
what it is? It
yeah.
annoys me in a perverse way because I'm not using this medication. I've got no tie into the sales or no lack of sales of this particular product. I don't consider myself obese. I'm certainly a big person in terms of muscle and the sheer amount of size that I have on my body. I don't have diabetes, so I've got no axe to grind. And for arguably, the fact we're doing a show shows that I have no axe to grind. So it annoys me in that particular way. It's irresponsible. Literally be quoting two individuals that had one or two issues, which arguably, as you said, with the kidney stone, may or may not be connected to the drug itself.
Yeah, so let's get into dosages and side effects. And, looking at these studies, look, at the end of the day, we've seen studies dosing range from 1 milligram up to 12 milligrams. We've also seen in the studies, as I said earlier, there was no difference between 8 milligrams and 12 milligrams. So in studies, they like to go a little higher on milligrams on purpose. That's part of the study, obviously, because they want to see did it make a difference. So I bet you if they went to 16 milligrams, there would be even less of a difference between. So you get to a point where it's the laws of diminishing returns. Same thing with using anabolic steroids or any other drug, right? So I don't see a point to run this more than 8 milligrams. And I think most of you out there would be no point in running this more than even 4 milligrams, as I said earlier. So the way I recommend running this, because you got to remember, it's a slow release drug. It's not going to peak in your system for 5 to 6 weeks. If you take it weekly on a consistent basis, it will not peak for 5 or 6 weeks. So I recommend the first week, you can start out with 1 milligram or start with 1.5 milligrams and then go from there. I started right in between that. I started at 1.2 milligrams. And then you can gradually increase it every 2, 3, 4 weeks, a little by little, till you get to a point where you're like, well, I don't like the side effects. I'm getting some side effects, and you drop it back down. That's what I did. I started out at 1.2 milligram. I went up to 1.8 milligram, and then I went to 2.4 milligram. And then I went back down to 2 milligram. I said, yeah, I'm starting to get some side effects. I'm getting a lot of results. I don't feel like I need a lot anymore, and I feel like I can drop that. So I dropped down to 2 milligram. And then I've been staying at 2 milligrams ever since. And that's a dose that I consistently stayed on and worked perfectly for me. So it also seems like, in my experience, other people's experience, the first 2, 3, 4 weeks is when you have the most side effects. And that makes sense. Okay. That makes sense because your body has to adjust to the drug and you have to adjust your dosing based on what works for you. So if you're an overweight person, and you weigh a hell of a lot more than I do, okay? I've never weighed more than 200 pounds in my life. I'm a short guy, 5'5", 5.6. So for me, that dosage works good. But if you're 250, 260, 300 pounds, you might want to start maybe at 1.5 milligrams, go to 2 milligrams, go to 2.5 milligrams, maybe even 3 milligrams. But I don't see any point going more than 4 milligrams. And then you can back off a little bit. But at the end of the day, look, there's no rule. It's not like taking anabolic steroids where you gotta get have this dosage and be consistent and all of a sudden this isn't the same thing, So you can be a little flexible with it, but just keep in mind if you jack your dose up too much and then you want to drop it back down, it's gonna take time for it to be out of your system. So don't put yourself in a bind where you're jacking up the dose too fast because it would still be in your system for so long that you don't want to get that. So I would do it that way and kind of pyramid it up a little bit, then find a dose you like and stick to that dose, maybe back it off a little bit, and then go from there. So how often should you dose? This was designed to be dosed once a week. If you read the studies, it was designed to dose once a week. Now we have people who like to microdose. I know people personally, I have clients who do a lot better mobster by splitting the dose twice a week. They do better when it comes to side effects. They swear that when they run the full amount, like that later that day or the next day, it's really difficult on them. They get some nausea, they get some issues. So for them, splitting the dose, like taking it on Sunday and then waiting till like Tuesday or Wednesday, works perfectly for them. So that is an option that you can do if you want to kind of chop up the side effects a little bit. But you know what? On paper, that shouldn't matter because of the long half-life. But people swear that that helps. So maybe there is a little bit of a bump in the way the drug is reacting in your
Yeah,
body initially
maybe.
that could. So you could try that. But taking it every day, I can't agree with that. That doesn't make any sense. That defeats the purpose of the way the
No,
drug was designed.
exactly.
It was designed to be taken for 6 months or a year,
Yes,
once a
yes,
week to make it easy
yes.
on a diabetic or make it easy on
Exactly,
someone. It wasn't
exactly.
designed to be like insulin where you have to take it constantly after every sugary meal. So it kind of defeats the purpose of why they invented the drug in the first place and the way they set it up with an ester
Yeah.
to slow release.
There's a tiny argument here. Because of the way these products work, literally slowing gastric emptying, literally making you feel full, that the whole sort of preset, the whole design is supposed to be working around your stomach, around your digestion of food, and so on and so forth, and how you feel when you're eating food. We touched on another show, Steve, about one study looked at whether people were more likely to make bad choices with food. And the argument was actually that they was not. They didn't fancy crappy food as much as they did when he wasn't using the medication that we discussed. So what I've seen in the studies and what we've seen in the science when they were looking at just normal people that were obese and or type 2 diabetics was that when dosages, it took a day or two or a week or two, whatever, to get used to taking a particular dose. So for example, initial use, and you'd never taken this medication. You're not used to the slower gastric emptying. You're not used to the feeling full more often because of the medication. that took a little bit of a while to get used to. So the upset stomach, what they described as gastrointestinal stress, was literally that person not being used to how that feels. And then what happened after that was if they went from a lower dose and tweaked the dose upwards, or indeed even downwards, but typically upwards, i.e., 1.5 to 2 milligrams, et cetera, and depending upon the medication, the effects that you'd had earlier, you got again. So I would argue this. There might be, as Steve said, a less likely issue for gastrointestinal stress, regardless of the dosage, if you dose it more frequently than the previously prescribed once per week. But you are not, and this is probably as important as anything else for our typical demographic, Steve, you are not seeing greater weight loss. You are not, for example, if this was an anabolic, you're not gaining more muscle. You are not getting stronger, regardless of if it was once a week or every single day. I'd probably go, like Steve said, 2 times, maybe 3 times a week. But the reason for the once per week was literally, and again, 27,000 users in one of the GLP-1 GLP studies was done in that specific way, so you didn't have to have insulin in your bag, you didn't in the office, didn't you know the train or the way to work, you didn't need it for every fucking meal in case you had an issue with glucose going all over the place with your numbers, and specifically because they were more likely to have users. And again, these in the studies, they're all going to the clinic, Steve, once a week, just to make it easier and more likely to have people stay with and continue to use the medication because it's a once a week injection versus, for example, especially in studies, if the participants had had to go multiple times per week. Can you imagine if it was daily, Steve? And because it's a study, they've all got to go to the clinic every fucking day. But what they're realistically looking at here is you go to your doctors, or arguably at some point, Steve, do this injection yourself. I suspect that's going to be the end game, and have more people stick with using this medication long term. Now, this especially applies, never mind diabetes, it especially applies when it comes to fat loss and what they keep saying, weight loss. I'm going to say fat loss because that's what we realistically want. You're not looking to lose muscle. You're not looking to the lack of bone density as described earlier. You're looking to lose that surplus of fat. Your obesity is not you being too big and too muscular. It's being too fucking fat. So having people stick to something that is quote unquote easy to do makes the most sense. So that's the reason why it's designed that way. And that's actually arguably why we think it's so successful, Steve, as well.
So I talked about earlier about how some doctors are wary of these GLP-1s and they don't want to move their, type 2 diabetes patients over based on side effects. Well, here's why that's dumb, okay? It's dumb, but it's not dumb, and I'll explain why. So the main side effects that you're going to notice: diarrhea. I had it a couple times. It wasn't often. Heartburn, I did have it like week two, week three, like almost every day. It went away though completely once I lowered the dose. Nausea, which you can get definitely from overeating. Mobster got into that, and stomach upset what comes with it. But here's the thing: you can greatly reduce your chances of side effects by simply watching your diet and only eating clean food. So type 2 diabetics are notorious about not eating good. So they'll eat something that's not good for them. And then they'll take their diabetes medication to get their blood sugar back down. Then their blood sugar will drop too low. Then they'll have to eat something bad again to get their blood sugar back up. It's a constant roller coaster, up, down, up, down, up, down, all fucking day. And that's their life. It's fucking horrible. They have no energy levels because their blood sugar is fluctuating up and down all fucking day. So if the doctor, and I don't blame doctors for this, but I blame a lot of times the patient. They're not willing to change the way they eat, then they're going to have trouble on this drug. Because I'll give you an example. I went to a dinner party and I ate late. By the time the dinner was ready, the guests showed up late. By the time we were eating, it was past 8 o'clock. I never eat past 8 o'clock, ever. Okay. I always want to eat my dinner earlier to give me a chance to evacuate before bed, and then I can go to bed without being bloated. Well, in this case, I ate really late. I also ate a very high fat meal. It was a roast or something like that. That was very, very high fat. Okay. And the next day, I woke up in the morning and I was bloated as fuck. I was gassy. I couldn't go work out. I was pissed. I had a workout scheduled the next morning. I was really looking forward to it, and I couldn't do it. So I had to wait till later on in the day to go do my workout because I couldn't do it in the morning. So that's a perfect example of people who say, "Oh, I have stomach upset." Well, don't eat late. Don't eat foods you shouldn't be eating, and keep your portions smaller where you're able to, digest it okay. So if you have existing problems with your diet, you have existing problems with your stomach, then there's a possibility when you use this drug, it's not going to work out for you very well. But why not change the way you eat and start eating the correct foods? Most people out there do not know how to eat properly, and they don't understand that certain foods irritate their stomach. So if you're eating foods constantly that irritate your stomach, you need to figure out, you do an elimination diet and figure out which foods irritate your stomach and eliminate them. Some of you are going to be very have a hard time with dairy. Some of you are going to have a hard time with gluten. Some of you are going to have a time with garlic and onions. Some of you are going to have a hard time with sauces, tomato sauce. Like if I had tomato sauce on the stuff, whether I was on the stuff or not, I would have stomach problems. So imagine on the stuff.
Let me give you a classic example, and I'll ask Steve about this. I don't really drink what the Americans call soda, very rarely.
Oh.
And a classic example, so let me give you two examples which are prevalent in both UK and American societies, and that is drinking high sugar drinks, and you don't necessarily understand just how much high sugar drinks you're having. So that would be soft drinks like soda, specifically
Yeah,
full fat drinks.
beer as well,
And
fermented.
the other one is coffee from places like Starbucks and Costa's, etc. Haven't we seen the example, Steve, where they've put a jar on the table and it's the amount of sugar that people are getting just in the drinks, not in the foods,
Yeah.
just in drinking. It's been equivalent of like
Yeah.
21,
So it's,
16 to
yeah,
21
that's a good
teaspoons
point.
of
Yeah.
sugar.
It's not just
Yeah.
what you're
And then
eating, it's what
fuck
you're
both
drinking.
of those things are fuck with your
So,
stomach
yeah.
without the sugar, just on their own. And then with the
So,
sugar. So what?
ironically, this drug is a lot of you who have trouble eating clean, it forces you to eat clean because you're not going to want to be on the stomach. Like if you go to a sporting event, it's all junk food, right? And if you try to go to the bathroom at a sporting event, like people are on the toilet. They're constipated or they're on the toilet with diarrhea. They're on the toilet farting. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's disgusting. Like, what is wrong with you people? Why would you go to a sporting event to take a shit? Doesn't make any sense. Take a shit before you leave your home. You're that unable to control your bowels and you think that's normal? If you have stomach problems, you need to fix your stomach problems first before you get on this stuff, regardless. But this stuff will force you to eat clean because if you don't eat clean, you're going to pay the price. Now, one more thing I want to get into as well before we finish up, and it's very, very important, is the rebound effect when you come off. Now, you're taking something that changes the way your hormones act in your body. So when you take that away, after 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, once it's out of your system, that's no longer going to be in your body. It's just like taking Tren and getting super strong and super big on Tren, and then you stop taking Tren and you go from benching 400 pounds to benching 360 pounds because the Tren is no longer in your system, giving you that androgenic and anabolic effect, right? And giving you that protein synthesis, all those good things that these strong anabolic steroids give you. Well, retrudotride is the same thing. So when you come off the retrudotride, you're going to have a rebound. You're going to have a rebound in the appetite. You're going to have a rebound in body weight and body fat. Things are going to rebound. Things are going to reverse. And we've seen that as well in other studies on these GLP-1s like tirzepatide. You can go back and listen to the episode. The people who were on the studies, who they switched them from the tirzepatide to the placebo, gained a lot of weight back. Okay. And the people who stayed on the tirzepatide kept losing weight, even though they were eating the same diet, even though they were eating on the same exercise program. So the environment that your body is going to be in is going to change. So you want to be aware of that. I had a client recently come to me. He was a younger guy, mid-20s. He wanted to use these GLP-1s. And I told him, I was like, look, it's your body, your choice. You can do what you want. But I warned him. I said, if you come off the retrudotride, you're still really young. Let's say you go on it for 6 months and you have great results. You lose 5% body fat or whatever. You come off of it, there's a good chance that you will gain most of that back because, you're still young and it's not like you can just stay on this stuff. So a lot of people are making the decision, hey, I'm just going to add these GLP-1s to my existing hormone replacement therapy. And that would be something that you could do at a, you could run like 1 milligram every 2 weeks or something like that, or half a milligram a week, and just keep on it going forward because of the stuff it's doing in your system. Or the option is to actually come off and then use that rebound effect to your advantage. And we've seen people on the forum do that. They say, yeah, I get a rebound effect. I got a great appetite increase. I use that to my advantage to lean bulk. So I'll eat really, really clean. And I will exercise and lift like crazy, and I'll actually gain back a lot of weight, but a lot of the weight I gain is muscle, and they'll use that to your their advantage. So these are things to think about before you use this drug. I would not use this drug if I was too young for that reason, because you don't want to end up having to take something the rest of your life
Yeah.
because you don't want to come off, because you come off and you gain everything back. That is a drastic possibility that could occur, and the studies do show it.
I would absolutely encourage the users to not slack on the diet when they come off and not slack on their exercise and cardio. And arguably, Steve, be even more on point if they absolutely have to, in the same way that we get post-cycle after you've used an anabolic, you've added muscle and strength. And a lot of people lose, quote unquote, all their gains. But as I said on many shows and on the forums, as a lot of that is due to the going back to the habits that you had before. And I'd think that would especially apply in the general obese populations versus, again, demographics. So listen, we absolutely want your input in that particular regards. And we want to see more information on that and more kind of numbers that allow us to put out better information to you on these shows. Listen, guys. When you're listening to this show, you're after the best information. We want you to get the best results. We thank Parapharma for sponsoring today's, and we do that because Parapharma is a tried, trusted, and approved source, and they'll enable us to put out shows like we've done today. Let us know what you think. Have you had any success with Retta? Have you had any issues? Give the information to us. We can pass it on to our listeners. We can talk about this on the forums. We welcome you to come onto the forums. Let us know of your experiences because your information will be beneficial to the other listeners and other members of the forum. And at the same time, the information they have can benefit you. So let us know what you think, guys. Absolutely, Steve. So, as always with this, please note we are not doctors and the opinions are ours. It is our view and based on our experience and views on the topic. Our podcasts are for informational purposes and entertainment only, the freedom of speech and the First Amendment.